From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the U.S. acknowledges an unsuccessful rescue attempt in Syria. Is there still room for peace between Israel and the Palestinians?
We are now facing a situation where I believe the door has closed on a two-state solution.
Thailand's junta chief is chosen as prime minister by an appointed legislature. An NGO says weak health systems can't stop Ebola, and possibly shedding new light on the origin of the universe. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. The United States acknowledges it launched an unsuccessful military rescue operation earlier this year to free American hostages held by Islamic State group in Syria. VOA's Victor Beatty reports the announcement came the same day President Barack Obama condemned the execution of an American journalist and called for regional action to extract the IS extremist cancer before it spreads.
Pentagon spokesman Rear Admiral John Kirby said the United States attempted to rescue a number of U.S. hostages held by a particular captor network within IS in Syria. He said the air and ground operation was not successful because the hostages were not present at the targeted location. Presidential Assistant on Counterterrorism Lisa Monaco said the operation, which took place earlier this summer, was authorized by President Obama because of the assessment that the hostages were in increasing danger with each passing day. Rick Brennan, senior RAND Corporation political analyst and a career U.S. Army officer, says gaining actionable intelligence for such an operation is always a challenge, but he was surprised the Pentagon acknowledged publicly the unsuccessful mission.
Trying to get current intelligence for this type of operations is extremely difficult. We had so many attempts that were aborted, if you will, with bin Laden. Very rarely do you hear about the Department of Defense discussing these types of capabilities. So, yeah, it is odd that the Pentagon and the White House has come out to acknowledge that we conducted this type of raid and that it failed.
The Pentagon and White House statements were issued the same day Mr. Obama acknowledged the beheading of American freelance journalist James Foldy, seen in a gruesome video made public on Tuesday. He said the world is appalled by this brutal murder and denounced their acts of murder, abductions, torture, rape, and slavery.
From governments and peoples across the Middle East, there has to be a common effort to extract this cancer so that it does not spread. There has to be a clear rejection of these kind of nihilistic ideologies.
Mr. Obama said there is no place for IS militants in the 21st century. U.S. State Department spokeswoman Marie Harf Wednesday said Washington has spoken with a number of regional partners who understand how serious a threat IS poses.
We have talked to a number of partners who understand how serious the threat ISIL is, not just to Syria and Iraq, but to their countries as well. And countries in the region are very, very concerned about this. We've worked with them on working to cut off financing, working to cut off the flow of foreign fighters, so we can start to deprive ISIL of the oxygen that it's had and has really allowed it to flourish.
But terrorism expert Greg Barton, who heads the Center for Islam and the Modern World at Australia's Monash University, says the terrorist threat continues to grow in the region and IS continues to add fighters to its ranks.
We used to think they had maybe 6,000 militants in Iraq and a similar number in Syria. We're now seeing multiples of that number. We do know that many more foreign fighters have come in over the last few weeks, and we know that they're recruiting locally as well. And it looks as if they now have some force strength in the several tens of thousands.
Barton says the brutal execution of Foley is designed to provoke an angry response from the West that may be a way for the Sunni extremist group to tell would-be donors and recruits the world is at war with Islam. So far, he says, the Western response has been restrained. Despite militant threats to kill another captive American journalist, Stephen Sotloff, over U.S. aerial attacks on IS targets in Iraq, those strikes continued Wednesday with another 14 in the vicinity of the recently recaptured Mosul Dam. Brennan says the United States has little choice but to continue its aerial campaign in support of Iraqi and Iraqi Kurdish operations against IS.
If you fail to take action because of a terrorist threat, then it binds your hands to do the types of things that protect U.S. interests. I think that it's absolutely impossible for the president to try to back down and not do what he thinks is right because of a threat of an American being killed.
Writing Wednesday in the Commentary magazine, Council on Foreign Relations national security expert Max Boot said what is needed now is a coherent U.S. military strategy to annihilate IS. He said that would include an enhanced air campaign coupled with thousands of U.S. advisors and special operations troops working with moderate forces in Syria and Iraq to root out IS militants from their newly conquered territory. Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Air bombardments and rocket fire between Israel and Gaza intensified today after Israeli airstrikes killed three senior Hamas commanders overnight. VOA's Scott Bob reports from Jerusalem.
The Israeli military said its forces pounded rocket installations in the Gaza Strip as dozens of rockets landed in southern Israel. Israel said more than 200 rockets had been fired at Israel, and its forces had targeted more than 100 rocket installations in Gaza since a temporary ceasefire collapsed on Monday. The Hamas group that controls Gaza announced that three senior Hamas military commanders had been killed in overnight airstrikes. Israeli defense forces confirmed the deaths. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said following a meeting of his security ministers that the operation against Gaza would continue. He said only the guarantee of the calm and safety of Israeli citizens will bring an end to this operation, and therefore we are talking about a long and continuing campaign. He added that Hamas leaders were not only legitimate targets, but targets of high priority. Hamas spokesman Sami Abu Zuhri said the threat reflected the extent of Israel's violence and lack of seriousness in achieving a ceasefire. He said these threats will not frighten Hamas leaders. On the contrary, we will continue to protect and defend our people in facing Israeli crimes. Hamas's military wing threatened to launch attacks against Israel's main airport near Tel Aviv. The airport Thursday appeared to be operating normally. Each side accuses the other of breaking the temporary ceasefire Monday after 10 days of negotiations and calm. Some progress had been reported in the talks on a permanent truce brokered by Egypt, but the two sides remained far apart on their principal demands. Hamas wants Israel to end the 7-year-old blockade of Gaza, while Israel wants all militant groups in Gaza to disarm. During the 6 weeks of violence, more than 2,000 Palestinians have been killed, most of them civilians, according to Palestinian authorities. On the Israeli side, 64 soldiers and 3 civilians have been killed. Scott Bob, VOA News, Jerusalem.
Marwan Muasher with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, in a new article, poses the question, what are the chances of both Israelis and Palestinians enjoying a stable future? Well, we asked him.
I've been an advocate of a two-state solution for over 20 years. I've worked hard in my earlier government career to contribute to that solution. But I'm afraid that 20 years after the Oslo process started, we have reached a situation where settlement activity, facts on the ground, are making it almost impossible for a two-state solution to be implemented. Today we face a situation where the settlers in the West Bank and East Jerusalem are more than 500,000 people in an area of 2.5 million Palestinians. It is becoming very, very difficult to separate the two communities. And even though the parameters of a solution are known to everybody, a Palestinian state on most of the West Bank and Gaza, decent security for Israel, shared Jerusalem between the two communities, even though that solution has been agreed to, negotiated, in fact, in for the most part, by the parties themselves, the political will to move from there to an actual agreement is lacking. It is lacking between the two parties. It is lacking also among the international community. And we are now facing a situation where I believe the door has closed on a two-state solution.
Is Israel going to be able to disarm Hamas?
I don't think so. We have seen this movie before. Remember that this is the third incursion Israel had into Gaza in the last 5 years. We can add to that another incursion into Lebanon in 2006 against Hezbollah. None of these incursions have been able to disarm either Hamas or Hezbollah. In fact, one can argue that it made both organizations stronger, both in terms of the public opinion in the Arab world, but also in terms of rearming themselves. The core question remains the occupation. And unless one addresses that particular question rather than symptoms of it, such as the tunnels, the blockade on Gaza, etc., as long as that core question is not addressed, I'm afraid that we're going to see more ceasefires followed by more incursions followed by ceasefires, as we have seen in the last 5 years. These are all interim solutions, but they will not be able to address the core issue.
Is it going to take a change in Israeli leadership in order for peace to come to this region?
It depends on who you ask. I believe that the current Israeli coalition is not interested in a serious agreement and a serious two-state solution. They do not show signs of it. They seem to want to have the cake and eat it, and that is not possible. Israel can, you know, either choose to be an occupation force or a democratic and Jewish state, but it cannot be a democratic and Jewish state if it is ruling basically over a majority of the population under its control. And today we are already in a situation where the number of Arabs and the number of Jews in areas under Israel's control are exactly the same, 6 million to 6 million. So we are very rapidly approaching the time when the demographic issue will kick in and when the absence of a two-state solution is going to be against not just Palestinian interests, but Israeli interests as well.
Marwan Muasher, researcher on the Middle East at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, speaking with us from Beirut.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
The army chief who deposed Thailand's civilian government 3 months ago has been selected as the kingdom's prime minister. VOA correspondent Steve Herman in Bangkok reports General Prai Ut Chanuchun was the only candidate nominated for the job.
A hand-picked legislature stacked with military officers held a vote to select the country's prime minister. One by one, all of the appointed legislators were called on by name. They stood and verbally endorsed the nomination of the only candidate, Army General Prayut Chan-o-cha. A few minutes later, after 191 legislators voted, the Assembly's president, Pornpech Wichicholchai, declared the name of General Prayut Chan-o-cha as elected prime minister is accepted and proposed for royal endorsement. The approval by the frail 86-year-old King Bhumibol Adunadet is seen as a formality and expected within a week. The general did not attend the legislative session. He was at a military base for a ceremony marking the anniversary of an infantry regiment. Criticism of the authoritarian process to select a new government leader is muted in Thailand. Martial law remains in effect. No public demonstrations are permitted. The domestic media operates under the scrutiny of the military. But Thai critics abroad, some of whom are now considered fugitives by the junta, as well as anonymous commentators on social media, are decrying the process. Some made humorous comparisons between the current government structure in Thailand and that of North Korea, where a single political party and a rubber-stamp legislature have always been the rule. An associate professor at Kyoto University's Center for Southeast Asian Studies, Pavin Chachavapongpon, says such an analogy should be taken seriously.
I don't think this is a joke. There are so many parties that can be compared between the two countries, especially some kind of political absurdities, people living in their own political fantasy. It's just too good to be true. It's too surreal.
General Prayut deposed the government on May 22nd, arguing it was necessary to end the political turmoil following 6 months of dueling and sometimes deadly street rallies. The army chief has previously announced a comprehensive plan to reform Thai politics and return happiness to the people. A military officer with the junta, officially known as the National Council for Peace and Order, told VOA News shortly after the coup that one of its primary goals is to permanently eradicate the influence of Thaksin Shinawat, who was ousted as prime minister in a coup in 2006. Parties he has backed have won every national election since 2001. General and now prime minister-elect Prayut is scheduled to retire as army chief next month at age 60. He has promised national elections following political reform, a process he has said would take at least 1 year to complete. Pavin, based in Japan and whose Thai passport has been revoked by the junta for failing to return home for questioning, contends the army chief has harbored a desire for the prime minister's job.
This is not about returning power to Thai people. This is not about reforming Thai politics. It's not about trying to look for a date of election. But indeed, this is a part of entrenching the military power in politics in order to make sure that they could come up with certain kind of political mechanism that would prevent Thaksin proxy to come back.
Since the coup, General Prayut has appeared in uniform each week to address the nation at length on television, covering a wide range of topics. No subject seems too minor to be noted by the junta boss, who has spoken about the need to clean stormwater drain pipes and admonish taxi drivers who overcharge tourists. Thailand's civilian governments, since the end of absolute monarchy in 1932, have frequently been pushed aside by generals. The U.S. Embassy in Bangkok says it takes note of the latest development, and the United States hopes it is a step in a process that leads to a freely and fairly elected civilian government. General Prayut's coup has been condemned by many Western governments. Thailand's internal turmoil appears to have had an impact on the country's economy, the second largest in Southeast Asia, which shrank in the first half of this year. Thailand, a popular holiday destination, has suffered a 10% drop in the number of foreign tourists this year. But many Thais say they feel more secure now that the bloodless coup put an end to the sometimes violent demonstrations. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
The West African countries at the center of the Ebola outbreak have at least one thing in common: weak healthcare systems. Experts say that prevented Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone from responding quickly and effectively to the epidemic. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
The international nonprofit NGO, Management Sciences for Health, says that strong health systems are key to a successful response to Ebola and other infectious diseases. Dan Nelson is the organization's expert on fragile states. He describes what's often lacking in countries with weak healthcare systems.
They tended not to have sufficient qualified personnel. They tend not to have routine data collection systems that are reliable, so it's difficult to get good planning. Poor facilities, lack of equipment, lack of supplies, lack of essential medicines.
He says there's a reason many developing countries have not invested in their health systems.
Many of them are financially strapped to begin with, especially those in conflict or post-conflict. During times of conflict, generally resources can be siphoned off for the war effort or for general security. Also, these tend to be poorer countries. So if you look at basic economic indicators, you're going to find that most of the fragile states are indeed quite poor to begin with and have a hard time funding, even in the best of times, health facilities.
What's more, Nelson says, these countries often lack infrastructure for educating and training health personnel. Also, many health workers come under attack, not only in conflict situations, but in the Ebola-affected countries. Many have been threatened by residents of towns and villages when they have attempted to deal with the Ebola outbreak. Much of that has been blamed on fear and stigma surrounding the disease. There's also a shortage of health workers in developing countries. Many leave for better jobs in richer nations. In Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone, many health workers themselves have been infected by the Ebola virus.
Generally, the healthcare workers are on the front line. Sometimes they're insufficiently trained to deal with a situation like this, and sometimes they have insufficient equipment. You see the WHO, CDC people coming in with these contamination suits in which they are completely blocked from any threat of contamination. And even with those suits, sometimes you still find some contamination. Sometimes it's just bad luck. Despite having the suit, you could still have a needle stick that would puncture the suit and you could still become infected.
The Management Sciences for Health official says in building a strong healthcare system, It's very important to get women involved. Also, the system needs to be resilient, strong enough to withstand shocks and trauma. The Ebola outbreak and natural disasters are two examples.
Especially in Africa, where most of my experience is, you find that there's an amazing amount of creativity and problem solving. They're used to working in situations with very poor infrastructure, and they're used to being able to get things done. But they do need resources.
He says it's important to work with the local population in building health systems. He says when bringing in outside medical personnel to help in a crisis, they should be made familiar with the local culture and customs. One of the problems health workers have faced in the Ebola outbreak is a denial among some that the disease even exists. Nelson says targeted education campaigns can help. This includes the use of local radio in rural areas. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
In 1999, the U.S. Space Agency launched an unmanned craft named Stardust on a mission to capture particles from a comet and some of the interstellar space dust streaming through our galaxy. VOA's Roseanne Skirbel has an update on recent findings, which could shed new light on the origin and evolution of the universe.
The precious cargo was parachuted back to Earth in a canister in 2006 and recovered in the American Southwest. Scientific analysis of its contents determined the target comet contained rocks formed near the early sun. Now a study of the dust between the stars reveals these tiny rocks may come from beyond our solar system. University of California, Berkeley physicist Andrew Westfall is lead author. Writing in the journal Science, he says the interstellar sample has already yielded data impossible to gather from land or space-based telescopes.
The big surprise is that these particles are not all the same. They are each different from each other. And so we're getting our first glimpse into the diversity and complexity of interstellar dust on a particle-by-particle basis and within the particles themselves, which are really complicated objects.
The particles are tiny, more than 1,000 times smaller than a grain of sand.
So the challenge we had was when the mission came back, how do we figure out where the particles are in the collector? And to do this, we recruited the help of citizen scientists from all over the world. More than 32,000 people have been participating in this project, and they've collectively done more than 100 million searches using a tool that was developed to run on a web browser.
The needle in a haystack search yielded some 100 thin-line tracks of suspected particles lodged in the aerogel and aluminum parts of the collector. The study reports on 7 of those particles that remained intact. Westfall and the 65 co-authors suggest those specks may be from outside our solar system, perhaps created in a supernova explosion millions of years ago and altered by exposure to the extreme space environment.
But there's more work to do, and one of the things that we need to do next on the particles, particularly in the aerogel, is to, turns out, to measure the relative amounts of the 3 stable isotopes of oxygen. And that will really tell us about interstellar origin.
If these 3 different forms of oxygen do not match up, then Westfall says it's probable they come from beyond our solar system.
But the challenge we have is that these particles are so tiny that in the process of trying to make the measurement, we could easily lose them. And so we're going to be practicing over the next 2 or 3 years, refining our techniques and practicing over and over and over on analogs to make sure that our techniques are sufficiently reliable that we won't lose them when we do the real thing.
Westfall says the 7 grains are a small but important step in unraveling the mystery of how materials cycle through our galaxy.
As material condenses into stars and into solar systems, and then stars evolve and they synthesize new nuclei and new kinds of new atoms, which are then ejected back out into the interstellar medium to make a new generation of stars.
A process, Westfall says, has been going on since the galaxy's creation. In addition to this study, researchers are releasing another 12 articles in the journal Mediatrics and Planetary Science on the methods and techniques used to handle the fine grains of space dust. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.
This is Today in History. On August 21st, 1831, a bloody slave revolt led by Nat Turner began in Virginia. The rebellion was crushed 2 days later. Turner eluded authorities for 2 months before being captured, tried, and executed. On this date in 1858, the first of 7 debates between Republican Abraham Lincoln and Democrat Stephen Douglas for an Illinois Senate seat occurred in the town of Ottawa. A recurrent issue in the debates was slavery. Although Lincoln lost the election, his eloquence in opposing slavery launched him to national prominence. Lincoln went on to win the presidency in 1860. In 1878, the American Bar Association, a voluntary association of lawyers and law students, was founded. In 1904, American jazz pianist, bandleader, and composer William James Count Basie was born. Basie was a leading musician during America's swing era in the 1930s and 1940s. In 1944, representatives of the United States, the Soviet Union, the United Kingdom, and the Republic of China began a series of meetings in Washington. What was known as the Dumbarton Oaks Conference led to the founding of the United Nations. On August 21, 1959, U.S. President Dwight D. Eisenhower signed an executive order proclaiming Hawaii the 50th state of the Union. In 1968, Private First Class James Anderson was posthumously awarded the Medal of Honor for heroism during the Vietnam War, becoming the first black Marine to receive the nation's highest military award. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is deeply concerned over the sentences handed down to 4 more Russian protesters who participated in the Bolotnaya Square demonstrations in Moscow in May 2012. During those demonstrations, thousands of Russians took to the streets protesting disputed election results and Vladimir Putin's return to the presidency of Russia. According to Amnesty International, the demonstrations were mostly peaceful, but were violently dispersed by the police, who arrested hundreds of protesters. Since then, more than a dozen Bolotnaya demonstrators have been tried and given prison sentences. In its most recent human rights report on Russia, the U.S. State Department notes that human rights groups believe that the arrest, detention, and punishment of such a diverse group of individuals were meant to deter the population from engaging in public protests. In addition, after the Bolotnaya protests, the Russian government began a crackdown on dissent, which includes, the State Department said, selectively employing a law on foreign agents, the law against extremism, and other means to harass, pressure, discredit, and/or prosecute individuals and entities that voiced criticism of the government, including non-governmental organizations, independent media outlets, and the political opposition. At a press briefing on August 18th, State Department Deputy Spokesperson Marie Harf expressed deep concern over the latest sentences of Bolotnaya protesters. Alexander Margolin and Alexei Gaskarov were sentenced to 3.5 years in prison, Ilya Gushchin to 2.5 years. Yelena Katarova received a suspended sentence, all on charges of taking part in mass protests and rioting. Ms. Harf noted that the verdicts follow those of 2 other individuals last month who were accused of organizing the protests. These politically minded trials have been marked by a lack of due process, and arrests of other participants continue more than 2 years after the demonstration, said spokesperson Harf. The Russian people deserve a government that values the contributions of all its citizens, that cultivates an open marketplace of ideas, and that respects universal rights and fundamental freedoms.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.